Friday, January 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The U.S. President Donald Trump has been impeached, and House Democratic case managers are making their case.
The president has spent weeks and months, if not years, inciting violence.
But Trump supporters warn it could galvanize his base.
They believe in what they believe, and that's not going to change.
And coronavirus experts from the World Health Organization land in China. We'll have these stories and more next. The U.S. House of Representatives impeached President Donald Trump on Wednesday. Legislators declared he incited insurrection last week when he implored thousands of his supporters to march to the Capitol to try and overturn his reelection loss, prompting a mob demonstration that turned into deadly mayhem. His impeachment trial could begin as soon as 1 p.m. on January 20th, Inauguration Day, for President-elect Joe Biden. Representative Madeline Dean is one of the House impeachment managers and outlined the case against President Trump in an AP interview.
The American people saw what happened here. The president has spent weeks and months, if not years, inciting violence. Sadly, on Wednesday, the 6th of January, the president invited this mob, a mob to the White House. It wasn't any day of the week. It wasn't any field trip. It was the very day that we in Congress were going to do our constitutional duty of certifying the election of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. The president inciting them, riling them up, saying he would be with them as they marched up the street, which of course was one of his many lies, saying that the election was stolen, which is the big lie. They came and they attacked the Capitol. Five people are dead. Their ambition was to assassinate the speaker, to hang the vice president, and to hunt down members of Congress. The American people witnessed that. That amounts to high crimes and misdemeanors.
She also said it was puzzling that the Senate hasn't been called back into session in the waning days of the Trump administration to take up the issue. AP correspondent Rita Foley reports that Republican Senate leader Mitch McConnell may be backing away from President Trump.
Here's what the Republican strategist told us. Republican Senate leader Mitch McConnell spoke to major GOP donors over the weekend to get an idea of how they feel about President Trump. They told him they think President Trump clearly crossed a line, according to the strategist. McConnell told them he's finished with President Trump.
But Trump supporter Douglas Noel, interviewed by Sky News as he visited the Alamo in Texas, says the decision to impeach President Trump could reinvigorate his base.
They believe in what they believe, and that's not going to change because of somebody else's political tactics or because somebody else believes differently.
The House vote branded President Trump with a singular distinction, making him the first president in the country's 245-year history to be impeached twice. The White House has not yet directly commented on the president's impeachment. So, what does this all mean for the American political landscape moving forward? Well, that's the question I put to Villanova University political science professor Matthew Kerbel.
I mean, pretty clearly, this is not the way Joe Biden would choose to come to office. I think new presidents always want a clean break with the past. They want to be able to move their agenda. They want to be able to set that agenda and set priorities in Washington. And to a certain extent, this is going to preclude the new president, Joe Biden, from being able to do that because he will now come into office in the shadow of his immediate predecessor and in the shadow of the events that just transpired in the Capitol. So, to that extent, because this is unprecedented, we really don't know how it's going to play out. But it's pretty clear that the business of the new administration, including confirming the cabinet and moving on some of the items that Biden has said are urgent priorities, will now have to share the stage with an impeachment trial.
What about to the American public? Because some Trump supporters have said by following through on impeachment, it may energize the president's base. Republicans during the debate were saying that this was a divisive process, but Democrats were saying this is our duty. There was an attack on the Capitol. They feel that the president incited the riot, and this is their responsibility.
Yeah, it's It's very hard to imagine supporters more energized or doing something more divisive than what we've already seen. So, I mean, I think the argument about, that some of the president's supporters are making that we need to move past this, it's honestly, it's a little hard to take that seriously, given the magnitude of events that have already transpired. I think if there is going to be an opportunity to move beyond this, it seems that there would need to be an accounting of what happened, who was involved, and to the extent that there were people involved who broke the law, to hold them accountable legally.
What do you see as potential issues for the Republican Party moving forward? Because you had Liz Cheney, the number three Republican in the House, saying that, you know, we must hold the president accountable. 10 Republicans voted for impeachment. The rest did not. So what challenges as a party do you see them facing?
I think it's a big challenge. And as Donald Trump now leaves power but does not exit the stage, I think the big question for the Republican Party is how much sway does he continue to hold over the party, over the party's strongest supporters? And I think it even raises the question of whether his supporters are the party's strongest supporters. You know, one of the stories that I think has gotten lost in the events of the past week or so is Georgia, where you can make the case that the reason Democrats won both seats in Georgia and consequently won control of the Senate is because of the messaging that came from the president. And, if his voters don't show up to vote for other Republicans, then I think it's an open political question about his value going forward. But on the other hand, because his voters are so loyal to him, it's really not an easy decision for Republicans to make whether they stay with him or whether they abandon him. I would say that some of the signals we've gotten from Mitch McConnell over the past couple of days about his openness to and conviction in the impeachment trial, I think that's telling, because I think that will be a really good indication, at least from the standpoint of Republicans in government, Republicans in Congress, as to how they're going to navigate this genuine minefield going forward.
That was Matthew Kerbel, a political science professor, and he teaches at Villanova University in Pennsylvania. A series of Israeli airstrikes on eastern Syria this week killed at least 57 people, most of them fighters, according to international monitoring groups. The Israeli targets were Iranian weapons storehouses. While Israeli strikes on Syria are common, the large number of people killed and the timing just days before President-elect Joe Biden takes office could spark tensions not only between Israel and Iran, but the United States and Iran. Linda Gradstein reports.
Israel has not claimed responsibility for the airstrikes, which analysts saw as a major operation against Iran's continued efforts to establish a permanent military presence in Syria. Syrian reports said at least 15 sites were targeted and that dozens of people, mostly fighters from Iranian-backed militias, were killed. Retired Brigadier General Asaf Orion is a senior fellow at the Institute for National Security Studies.
This strike, as much as it was conducted by Israel, which is the probable explanation, is in the context of Iran and Israel's long campaign in Syria, and that's, I would say, in a wider scale, Iran's proxy warfare across the Middle East. Because what we're seeing is that the Iranian art of war is based on fighting on other people's lands by other people's hands.
He said what he found unique about these airstrikes were the large scope and the location, 500 kilometers from Israel, near the border between Iraq and Syria. General Orion says Iran is using proxy militias to taunt Israel.
What Iran is doing in Syria is actually putting a military capability on Israel's border, allowing it to attack, harass, distract, divert Israel, and deter it if they could.
The tensions between Israel and Iran come just days before President-elect Joe Biden will be inaugurated. Biden has said he wants the U.S. to return to the Iranian nuclear deal, which President Donald Trump pulled out of in 2018. Israel worries that the deal will give Iran a legal way to acquire a nuclear bomb. But Iran has recently begun enriching uranium to 20%, a step on the way to crossing the nuclear threshold. Israel television security correspondent Roei Sharon says the timing plays an important role. He said Israel is using the last days of the Trump administration to attack Iran because Iran won't want to respond now. But some Israeli analysts say Israel is playing a dangerous game and that if pushed hard enough, Iran will strike back. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
And coming up later,
let this mission and let other missions be about the science, not about the politics.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
New studies in the journal Nature detail the discovery of not only the first ever fast radio burst generated in the Milky Way, but also the possible source of this relatively new astronomical phenomenon. Canada's Chime Fast Radio Burst collaboration analyzed data gathered by its radio telescope array and detected a fast radio burst on April 20th, 2020. This prompted a team from Caltech to sift through data gathered by its STARE-2 radio receivers, where they also detected the same fast radio burst. The two teams found evidence that this rare and elusive event was produced in the Milky Way from a type of neutron star known as a magnetar. Up until now, all detected fast radio bursts were found to be generated in other and often distant galaxies. A magnetar is a special type of neutron star that has an incredibly powerful magnetic field. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. China, with its population in excess of 1.4 billion, is the most populous country on Earth, although it is closely followed by India. It's also home to the second largest global economy and wields its influence across the globe. So, what's in store for Chinese geopolitics in 2021? That's the question I put to Roger Baker, Vice President for Strategic Analysis at Stratfor, a RAIN company, which recently published an outlook for the country.
A couple of directions that we've been looking at. One is looking at the evolution of the U.S.-China relationship. 2021 is going to be an interesting year. We have a change in the U.S. administration and potentially some change in the tactics in which the United States deals with China, but probably not as much in the broader strategy. I think that the perception that China is the primary strategic competitor to the United States is a bipartisan concept in the United States. It's more about the ways in which that is pursued. At the same time, we have a China that on the one hand is trying to lock in its gains in Hong Kong, in permanently altering Hong Kong. I think it's everything but a recognition that one country, two systems is no longer valid, at least from the Chinese point of view. At the same time, this year marks the 100th anniversary of the Chinese Communist Party. Next year is the Chinese hosting of the Winter Olympics. And we anticipate the Chinese to potentially, with the exception perhaps of Hong Kong and Taiwan, try to ease some of the tensions that they have with many of their neighbors and potentially even with the United States to avoid crises during these key moments that they have this year. So, for all the stress and strain in the U.S.-China relations, there is some potential for a little bit of softening over the next 12 months.
Roger, I want to follow up regarding Taiwan. The State Department, in the waning days of the Trump administration, has repealed an internal guideline kind of focusing on how U.S. administration officials interact with those from Taiwan. And wanted to get your take on how that may influence things.
Well, I think it's interesting. If you look at what they did, they basically lifted an internal set of restrictions or policies around how and when U.S. officials can and can't meet with Chinese officials. But it doesn't require anything to happen. So what it does is it opens a capability but it doesn't require that capability to be acted upon.
One last question here. You are someone who really pays close attention to Asia, to China, and there are people around the world who casually observe what's taking place in Asia and China's geopolitical influence. So my last question to you is this. You know, what is something that you see in your research that perhaps the casual observer may have missed?
Well, I think one of it is really that the Chinese themselves are internally reassessing the Belt and Road Initiative. You know, everybody in the West has made big deals about it, or it's debt trap diplomacy, or it's Mackinder's worst nightmare, and China is now dominating all of Eurasia through this, or things of that sort. But in many ways, the Chinese sort of overstepped and allowed too much freedom in the early development of BRI. And they're finding that they need to go back and tighten up their regulations on their own companies, strengthen the way in which they deal with the countries around them so that they avoid political challenges and security challenges, and look and say, where are they really going to make some profit and not? Because just like everybody else, the Chinese have faced a big hit from the COVID economic crisis, even though they look like they're recovering faster than other people coming out of it. A second thing I would say is that as the Chinese try to reshape their economy, both coming out of COVID and from an intentional direction of saying they can't just be a outbound economy, they need to be an inward economy. And you have Xi Jinping talking about his circular economy and things of that sort. It is impossible to understate the fact that it's about 450 million active people on the coast who are part of the main Chinese economy, and about 800, 850 million people in the interior who aren't. And that economic disparity, even if it's not poverty versus riches, is going to impact how the Chinese government looks forward at what they're doing. And the final is that just as the United States is starting to target its own technology companies for being monopolies, the Chinese are doing so too, and we may be seeing a reshaping of the Chinese state involvement with its own technology companies.
Roger Baker is Vice President for Strategic Analysis at Stratfor, a RAIN company. A team of World Health Organization experts landed in Wuhan, China, after months of accusations Beijing was obstructing an independent investigation. As VOA's Bill Gallo reports, the team will try to uncover the origin of the coronavirus that has killed nearly 2 million people around the world.
The WHO's fact-finding mission in China did not get off to a great start. Chinese officials blocked two members of the WHO team from boarding their plane in Singapore after they tested positive for COVID-19 antibodies. The rest of the team landed Thursday in Wuhan, where they will spend about a month. The first 2 weeks will be in quarantine at the insistence of Chinese authorities. Beijing has repeatedly been accused of obstructing an independent investigation into the coronavirus. Beijing has also attempted to deflect blame for the devastation brought by the global pandemic. For the World Health Organization, it is a tricky diplomatic and political situation. WHO Emergencies Program Chief Mike Ryan insists the team does not intend to blame China or anyone else.
Let this mission and let other missions be about the science, not about the politics. We are looking for the answers here that may save us in future, not culprits and not people to blame.
More than 120 countries have called for an independent investigation into the origins of the virus. Many governments accuse Beijing of not doing enough to contain its spread. Outgoing U.S. President Donald Trump has been especially outspoken, frequently speaking of the China virus and demanding the United Nations hold Beijing accountable. China, for months, rejected calls for an international probe. But in July, China and the WHO finally agreed on a plan. China insisted on allowing its scientists to do the initial research. That research could be invaluable, says Archie Clements, an infectious disease expert at Australia's Curtin University.
It's not like nothing's been happening for the last 12 months. So there's a lot that's been happening, and a lot of evidence has already been generated. So one of the tasks of the WHO team is to go to China and to meet with the scientists and to look at the evidence.
But so far, China has not revealed what its scientists discovered. Clements hopes the WHO team will soon gain access to that data.
A big part of these sorts of investigations is actually around developing relationships with people, having that personal contact, being able to ask questions privately in a safe environment. you know, building rapport, having the sort of conversations that, the open-ended conversations that may bring out things that you hadn't previously anticipated might be important.
The coronavirus was first discovered in late 2019 in Wuhan. Many experts believe the virus had long been present in bats, but was transferred to humans through another wild animal sold at a market. With the absence of facts, disinformation and speculation have abounded. Some U.S. officials have suggested the virus may have leaked from the nearby Wuhan Institute of Virology, one of China's top research labs. China has increasingly rejected the idea the virus originated in its country at all. Some state media reports claim it may have been imported by way of frozen seafood from Italy. A team of Chinese scientists recently argued the virus originated in the summer of 2019 in India. In March, a Chinese foreign ministry official offered an unfounded theory the U.S. military may have brought the epidemic to Wuhan. The World Health Organization hopes its team will soon offer answers, even if preliminary. And experts like Clements agree.
What I would hope is that politicians, global leaders, give the investigator team some space to be able to do their job, which is a scientific task. It's not a political investigation.
But WHO officials have cautioned the team may not conclusively trace the exact origin of the virus. That's in part because, experts say, viruses change very quickly. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
Ugandans wearing face masks to brave the pandemic turned out in force on Thursday to vote. This election pits longtime leader Yoweri Museveni against the popular singer and lawmaker Bobi Wine. Long lines of voters snaked out of the polling stations in the capital of Kampala, a stronghold for an opposition galvanized by Wine, despite a campaign scarred by deadly crackdowns. There are roughly 17.7 million registered voters in Uganda, and results of the election are expected within 48 hours.
My name's Eric Schreiner. I'm the Chief of Interpretation and Visitor Services at Tonto National Monument. We were established primarily to protect two large cliff dwellings, and these cliff dwellings date back to 700 years ago. They were part of a group we call the Salado, but it would be the ancestors of the modern tribes in Arizona, New Mexico. So the Apache, Yavapai, the Hopi, the Zuni, the Tohono O'odham, and southern tribes. So we have affiliation with several tribes in the area, and these are their ancestors who built these dwellings. One dwelling is around 20 rooms, another dwelling is around 40 rooms. They're pretty substantial standing walls, roof still intact, a lot of artifacts still, especially at the upper dwelling, still in place. So they're very well preserved for being that old. We preserve them, we open them up for the public to responsibly visit, and we try to tell the story of these people that were here long before any European settlers. The upper dwelling we do just by guided tour. And we do that 4 days a week in the winter months. So here it's November to April. You're on a guided tour. So it's a small group. We answer questions, talk about the site with you, walk you through the site. It does require some pre-planning, but you can actually walk into some of the rooms, see some of the artifacts that are still there. You don't have access to everywhere because we want to try to avoid compacting some soils in certain areas or some really fragile areas we want to stay out of. The lower dwelling we have open every day. So when you go up there, there is, I would say, over 90% of the walls are original. The roofing that you see up there is the original. We didn't rebuild much of the dwelling. There's some walls that were cemented in place and some capping that was done to try to preserve the walls from falling down, some bracing. But basically the idea was when the Park Service came in the 1930s, they started to stabilize it. And they wanted to preserve what was there for the people to see it as it was when they came in the 1930s. If you're looking at it from the outside, especially if you're outside the Southwest, you know, somewhere around the world, Looking at this, it's all going to seem very similar. And, you know, you'll be like, well, what? You're kind of splitting hairs by creating these different groups. But what I like to think of it as is you have these big kind of overarching trends that are happening in the Southwest. And what happened is when archaeologists started studying this, and, you know, Southwest is one of the first places where archaeology was really sort of systematically approached and documented. They started seeing these differences in the pottery style, potentially. That's a big defining characteristic of these different sites. Oftentimes when I've talked to our affiliated tribal members, they don't really see it from their perspective as much different. They're all the ancestors. The thing that fascinates me, continues to fascinate me about our sites and what was found here, is it almost seems like what the people that lived here were really invested in creating really beautiful places to live. They live in these really prominent locations. They made these really ornate clothing to wear, made out of cotton, often with different designs and patterns and different techniques used for that, really colorful, bold pottery. So it seems like these people valued that beauty and in a really special way to invest that much time and effort into what they did here. So I think what's special about us is just the level of artistry here. And and you see that at a lot of places, but I think here especially just the diversity of different types of textiles and pottery and the skill involved with that is pretty amazing.
You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Just do it on your phone, your desktop computer, or any other electronic device. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a fantastic Friday.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
On November 26, 2008, 10 gunmen associated with the Pakistan-based foreign terrorist organization Lashkar-e-Taiba executed a coordinated attack on several targets in Mumbai, India. They targeted locations frequented by tourists, a train station, and a Jewish community center. The attack lasted several days, and once it was over, 166 people of 17 different nationalities lay dead, including 9 of the 10 attackers, and more than 300 people were wounded. The surviving attacker died by execution in November 2012, but Sajid Mir, the man who planned the attack, directed preparations for them, and served as one of the Pakistan-based controllers during the attacks, remains at large. Mir was indicted by the U.S. District Court of the Northern District of Illinois on April 21, 2011. Authorities issued a warrant for his arrest the following day. Mir was charged with conspiracy to injure property of a foreign government, providing material support to terrorists, aiding and abetting the killing of citizens outside of the United States, and the bombing of places of public use. In 2019, Mir was added to the FBI's Most Wanted Terrorist list. The U.S. State Department's Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to the arrest or conviction in any country of Sajid Mir or any other individual responsible for the attack. Sajid Mir was born in either 1976 or 1978 in Lahore, Pakistan. He is 165 to 167 centimeters tall and weighs around 60 kilograms. According to the FBI, Mir has discolorations on his face, a scar on his left cheek, and also on his right eye. Anyone with information about Sajid Mir should text Rewards for Justice via WhatsApp Telegram, or Signal at 202-702-7843. All information will be kept strictly confidential.
That was an international public service announcement by the